David mentioned in his prayer that we might be able to find and apply some of the things that we're studying from Daniel. And as you've noticed, the past several weeks when we've jumped into chapters, well, actually a lot of the book of Daniel has been very historical. And sometimes when you're dealing with a book of this nature, especially chapters 7 through 12, very prophetic in nature, where you've got to go back and you've got to look at a lot of history. And we're going to be looking a little more history this morning of the Grecian Empire and their interaction with the Jews and some of the things that Daniel is speaking of here. You do have sometimes trouble finding a little bit of application, things that strengthen our faith, things that help us day to day in this. So please, along the way, if you'd have something you'd like to share, we'll try to be making a little bit of application. When you understand God's eternal plan and God's purpose in bringing Jesus into the world, and you understand the Daniel's prophecy, he's speaking hundreds of years beforehand. At the end of this chapter, he's told to seal up the things he's writing. It really does strengthen your faith to understand that. And we've looked at that time and time again in this class, and we'll continue to emphasize that about how Daniel is recording these things. And it's interesting to note how things play out. The details of the visions that Daniel witnesses, they really play out in how history later, 150, 200 years down the road, comes to pass. And that should strengthen our faith in God. But along the way, if you have any comments or questions or applications or thoughts that you'd like to add, then feel free to interject those into our study. We will most definitely welcome those. Since we've got a few new faces in the audience, and since we're in Daniel 8, which can be a relatively challenging chapter, we'll just go ahead and do a very brief recap, since we're going to jump into verses 15 through 19 here in just a moment. But this is the vision that Daniel witnessed during the third year of Belshazzar regarding the ram and the goat. And you may remember this great battle takes place, and what he's essentially describing, he's setting the stage, the battle that takes place between the Medes and the Persians versus the Grecian army that's led by Alexander the Great. And as you read through the vision and as you see that the goat absolutely demolishes the ram, and it's just a very brutal fight. You go back and history shows us how Alexander the Great wasn't content just defeating Darius, who was leading the Medo-Persian army. He beats him with one battle, and then Darius withdraws with his army to another city, and Alexander the Great and the Grecians, they pursue him, and they beat him again there. And they run again, and the Grecians beat him again there, finally just utterly wiping out the Medo-Persian Empire. We see that this goat then becomes great. This mighty horn that it's got breaks. That's the death of Alexander the Great, who simply reigned 10 years at the head of the Grecian Empire. And although he accomplished a lot, his death was very untimely. He died at a very young age. And so this great horn breaks on this goat, and four others arise. Primarily, these were generals and other people in the Grecian government that inherited some sort of power over some portion of Alexander's great empire. In particular, which Daniel seeks to emphasize regarding the Jews and their history, or rather regarding the Jews and their future, one small horn grows out of these four, and it becomes particularly great. And it says it grows great toward the beautiful land, referring to Jerusalem. And it says it grows great, it grows up into the heavens, and in the process of growing up into the heavens, it casts some of the stars down. We understand that to be the little horn being Antiochus Epiphanes, who we've talked about in a good bit of detail. We're going to talk about him a little more this morning. And his persecution, his relentless persecution of the Jewish people, as he seeks to implement and Hellenize the nation. And the Jews' natural response is to reject that, the Grecian culture, the Grecian gods, the Grecian practices. His persecution on them in an attempt to force Hellenization down their throats. And so that's probably the falling of those stars, the death of some of God's people that withstood or tried to withstand Antiochus Epiphanes. And as we concluded last week, we saw there that there was going to be the removal of the daily sacrifice. And this was one of the most integral part of Jewish worship. That is, the sacrifice that was done on a daily basis before God, expressing the people's gratitude and appreciation and admiration for God. So that was going to be removed. And Daniel hears these two angels talking in the dream, in the vision, and they say, how long is it going to be? How long will the daily sacrifice be removed from the temple? One of them says to the other, for 2,300 mornings and evenings, and we understand that to be a symbolic number. So let's pick up our study, verses 15 through 19. Brother Campbell, would you mind reading those verses for us, please?
Daniel chapter 8, beginning from 15. This is from the King James Version. And it came to pass, when I, even I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as it touched me and set me upright. And he said, Behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the end of nation. And at the time appointed, the end shall be.
Let's just talk for just a moment, because Daniel uses this phrase twice in these two verses, this time of the end, or this time pertaining to the end. So we'll talk about that for just a moment. Daniel didn't have the benefit of understanding history. We look backward and we're able to tell all of the various elements of these visions that he witnesses, and we're able to see what it was God was foretelling. However, Daniel doesn't have that same hindsight that we have. He's looking at things that have not yet occurred, and so he's somewhat confused by some of the things that he's seen. And this voice sounds forth, Gabriel, go explain to Daniel what it is that he's just seen. Now, you'll remember in chapters 1 through 6, it was Daniel who was the revealer of dreams and the one who exposed visions to King Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar and other men during that time. But in chapters 7 through 12, as Daniel records these visions that he has, it's the angels who explain to Daniel what it is he's seen. And in this particular instance, we find Gabriel here named. And to my knowledge, this is our first encounter with Gabriel, an angel who's given a name in the book of Daniel. And so this voice speaks to Gabriel, go make known to Daniel what it is that he's seen. So let's stop for just a moment. Let's talk about Gabriel. Can you think of any other instances in the Bible where Gabriel's mentioned by name? In the New Testament? Okay. He comes and he announces the birth of Jesus to Mary. It's Gabriel. Remember, it's Gabriel who stands at the right hand of God. And so obviously, regarding the angelic hierarchy, Gabriel's somewhere high up there. He stands in the presence of God. We know many of the angels minister to God and serve God and accomplish God's purposes. And we'll talk a little more about angels later. But Gabriel stands there in the presence of God. He's given a name, one of the few angels that's identified by name. The other being, to my knowledge, Michael, who is an archangel. But Gabriel, who stands in the presence of God, is the one who's to make known to Daniel the meaning of this dream. He also, you may remember, appears to Elizabeth and announces the birth of John the Baptist, the one who would prepare the way for Jesus. So in Daniel 8, Daniel 9, we see Gabriel once again revealing to Daniel certain things that he's witnessed. And then those two particular instances in the New Testament, those are the only times we have Gabriel mentioned by name. And as Gabriel appears to Daniel and begins to speak to him, in verse 17, what impact, what effect does Gabriel have? Rotten Daniel pretty bad. And we've seen angels appear to others, and there are different responses. Gabriel, I don't know if it's because of his particular power or position or because of everything that Daniel's experiencing right now. Daniel becomes very frightened when Gabriel appears and prepares to make known to him the meaning of this dream. And then he says regarding this time of the end, Daniel mentions that twice in verses 17 and 19. Now, it's quite unfortunate that most of our translations probably interpret this as the time of the end in this matter. The book of Daniel already is misused by some who hold to premillennialistic ideas. And so this idea, or the usage of this phrase, the time of the end, really is taken out of context as to what Daniel is witnessing. The things that Daniel is seeing don't pertain to the time of the end in the sense end times with the second coming of Jesus and all of those things that they say are going to precede Jesus' return. Nothing in the context would lead us to think we're talking about here the destruction of the world, the return of Jesus and all of those things. That wouldn't even be known to Daniel at this point in time, as Jesus is 500, 600 years removed. He's yet to come to this earth. A more accurate translation of this particular phrase in verse 17, where Daniel talks about this time of the end, the New English Bible renders it such. And I think it helps us understand contextually what Daniel's referring to. Not end of days time, but rather, a more accurate rendering, the appointed time. This is this time that's coming upon the Jews. This great persecution that's going to come forth from this little horn, Antiochus Epiphanes, that appointed time is going to have its end. It's going to come to an end. And that's what Daniel is hearing, and as he's speaking, as Gabriel speaks to him, that appointed time that God has determined for those people to suffer the Jews to suffer at the hand of the Greeks is going to have a definite end. So that's a more accurate translation and understanding what Daniel means when he talks about these end times. And so, once again, we had a four-month class on angels whenever I first arrived. Talk about angels again for just a moment. You look down at verse 18 where the angel, as he's speaking to Daniel, he says, "While he was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground." For whatever reason, it causes Daniel to fall asleep or to faint or to swoon. We already saw in verse 17 the impact that Gabriel's appearance had on Daniel. This encounter of the spiritual being, particularly one as powerful and high up as Gabriel, caused him to be frightened. And so for whatever reason, Daniel faints, falls asleep whenever Gabriel starts speaking to him. You'd think his attention would be kept, and so that's probably why I think he probably leaned more toward faint. He became weak. He swooned as Gabriel's there. And excuse me. As Daniel then falls asleep or swoons, what does Gabriel do at the end of verse 18? Okay. Touched him, right? Made him stand upright. That's what my translation says. He touched me and he made me stand upright. As you consider the interactions that angels have throughout the course of God's word revealed, this is somewhat of a reoccurring thing. This is something that we see taking place time and again, where angels come and supernaturally strengthen men. Can you think of any other instances where this has happened, where you've got an individual who is weary, who was faint, and an angel comes and provides some sort of strength, divine strength? Can you think of any other instances in the Bible? Tommy, you look like you're going to say something. I've got a couple up here.
Moses' concubine and his firstborn son.
Okay.
When she was trying to, when they sent her away with her son, she was, you know, prepared to die. I thought they would die.
Hagar?
Hagar.
Okay, right. And an angel appears and strengthens her and gives her hope, speaks to her the fact that God's going to make a great nation out of her son Ishmael and not to be concerned. And she then sees the spring, and rather than having to see her son die of thirst, God supernaturally provided for her, strengthened her in that moment of great weakness. Miss Johnny?
Angels came to strengthen Jesus.
I think that's one that probably comes to all of our minds. You know, as you think of Jesus there in great weariness, and in fact, I think I have this. We'll get to that one here in just a second. A couple instances, twice with Jesus. Once early in his ministry, before his ministry began, when he goes into the wilderness for 40 days to be tempted by Satan, we see he's in the wilderness being tempted, and he's with the wild beasts, and the angels were ministering to him. Now we go and we read Matthew's account, we find out that he's fasted 40 days and 40 nights. Nothing to eat, probably very little to drink, and so his body's just undergone the duress of having no nutrition for this long period of time. And then on top of that, not only have you got this physical exhaustion, the state in which Jesus is in, Satan then comes. And these three temptations that Satan presents before him as he's fasted and is on the brink of physical exhaustion. So he's mentally and he's emotionally and he's physically exhausted. And we see at the end of that encounter in Matthew 4, after Satan leaves for the time, remember what the text says? The angels came and ministered to him. So Jesus was in a very weak state at that point in time. And yet we have the angels coming, strengthening him. Mark just kind of summarizes it in verse 13 by saying that. As Miss Johnny was pointing out, Jesus was in the garden. Once again, he's in this position of great distress, great weakness as he's there and as his end is approaching. And he knows what's coming and he knows what he's going to have to face. He has the cross before him that he's got to endure. And as he's there and as he's praying, and we see the exhaustion that's there from the lack of sleep, all of the stress due to the things that are about to take place. An angel, as his disciples are sleeping, an angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening them. And then one last occasion, this aren't the only occasion, but another occasion is when Paul's on the ship with the other prisoners and is rocking, both rocking and rolling, and they think they're all about to die. An angel comes and speaks to Paul, comforts him in that time of great distress. And then Paul, in turn, is able to provide comfort to the other passengers on the ship, telling them their lives are going to be spared, encouraging them to take heart, and to eat food. And so this is a theme that we see repetitively played out throughout Scripture, where you've got angels strengthening those who are faint. And Daniel here clearly swooned for some reason before this angel. Angel touches him. He gives him strength to stand back up because Daniel needs to hear what's going to be taking place. Daniel needs to hear these things that God is describing him. And although these are unique circumstances, we recognize there are moments in our lives when we desperately pray before God for strength, for comfort, for aid in moments of weakness. And we can probably all recall times in our life where we've just spent time in bitter prayer because we didn't know what else to do. There was nothing else that we, within our abilities, could do to bring about whatever it is we desired. And then we turn to Hebrews 1:14, and we don't know exactly how this plays out. I wouldn't stand before you and say that I've encountered an angel strengthening me in times of weakness, but we do have the promise of the Hebrew writer, Hebrews 1:14, where he's speaking there and he says, "The angels, are they not all ministering spirits sent out to render service for the sake of those who will inherit salvation?" We can't say how that takes place. The Bible tells us, as it's God's revealed word, how angels ministered to people during those days. However, we have this promise, and that's something to put hope in. That's something to comfort us in times of great distress. We may not necessarily, we're not going to see it. I've never encountered one. But who's to say the way that God works, those in the spiritual realm, coming, strengthening, and helping and assisting those who are going to inherit salvation, that is, Christians. And so we see in this particular instance, Gabriel reaches out, he touches Daniel. Daniel has the strength to rise. And then we see the revelation of Gabriel in the latter part of the chapter. Jimmy Dale, would you read for us the last seven verses of Daniel 8, verses 20 through 27, please?
The ground which you saw having two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. The male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first kingdom. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, kings shall arise, having fierce features, who understand sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully, and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty, and also the holy people. Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, and he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without human means. And the vision of the evenings and mornings, which was told, is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterwards, I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood
it. Thank you, Jimmy Dale. Now, we see here some of the explained symbols, and as you're reading through the book of Daniel, even today, as we look back at history and we look at all of the knowledge that we have before us from scholars who have taken and interpreted the various symbolism and the various aspects of the dreams that Daniel's witnessed, there are a lot of things that we just don't know, that we can't say with certainty, this is what the little horn in chapter 7 represents. And in this particular instance, Gabriel really helps us a lot. And he comes and he explains very clearly to Daniel. And Daniel needed to be awake and Daniel needed to be aware, because he's going to talk about some things that have great implication on God's people. This terrible ruler in verses 23 through 26, which we're going to look at a little bit later, that's going to arise. Daniel needs to know. Daniel needs to write these things down. Daniel needs to prepare God's people. And so Daniel has these symbols explained to him. And he says the various aspects of his vision of the goat and the ram. You'll remember the ram had two horns. One was bigger than the other, emphasizing the greater import of the Persian Empire over that of the Median. The ram, he said, the nations, the empires of the Medes and the Persian. The male goat, that's going to be Greeks. We go back and we look at history and we see the battles that took place between those two. And we understand very clearly that once again, Daniel is speaking truth. It's a lot less impressive on this side of history, but for the people who would later read these things as they were happening, whoa, how did Daniel know? to speak these things unless that there was some sort of divine intervention. And so the large horn, that being Alexander the Great, that's the first king of the Greeks and of the Macedonians. We know Philip of Macedon was king. He was Alexander the Great's father. But really, the king of those two united empires, the Macedons and the Grecians, that was Alexander the Great. The large horn was going to be the first king of that empire. The four horns were going to be the divided Grecian empire that would arise after the death of Alexander the Great. And so we come to the heart and soul of Daniel chapter 8. That's verses 23 through 25. The description here of a great persecutor that was going to come upon God's people. Now, God wishes to prepare, I believe, his people for this crisis that's going to be coming. But as you read about it, you're going to notice Daniel's going to be faint. He's going to be weary after he witnesses these terrible things. Because awful things are going to be coming to God's people. Let me ask you, maybe you have some thoughts on this. Why do you think God wants this revealed? Why does God want his people to know terrible things are coming? It's a reminder of the good, too, that he has promised. Good point. Ms. Johnny?
What happens in times of great distress? When times are turbulent, and this is going to be next to the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans in 70 AD, this is going to be the worst persecution that God's people ever experienced at the hands of Antiochus Epiphanes. And during those moments of great tribulation, and even in our small life, or maybe during the times of tribulation of our country, you think back to 9/11, and you got people all of a sudden turning to God, and you got people asking, who may not care about God at any time before, this great tragedy strikes, and the nation's topsy-turvy, and who knows what's going to happen next. What's going to happen? Is God going to continue to be with us? Is this country yet nearing its end? And even in our life, whenever things get somewhat questionable, we may find ourselves wanting reassurance that everything's going to be okay. And as both Ms. Johnny and Tommy both alluded to, I believe in part that's why this was given. It was a reminder that although I know all of these terrible things are coming, and in those moments we say, God, where are you? God says, I know all of these terrible things are coming. But because I know all of these terrible things are coming, I'm there standing at the end of it knowing that, as Miss Johnny said, there's going to be a definite end to the destruction, to the violence, to the oppression. Those things will come to an end. And so you think of the revelation of John, the very last book in our Bible. That's going to be the persecution of the Roman Empire upon God's people. And they're going to cry out. They're going to cry out for vengeance. They're going to want to know, when does this end? When will it cease? When will the persecution be lifted from us? And the exhortation in chapter 2, verse 10 of Revelation, be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. And so, because God foretells these things are coming, there is some comfort in knowing He is God. He knows. 200 years before these events come to pass, He has already said that they are. And so He waits at the end of that oppression, guiding us safely through, knowing that there will be an end. And you also have the exhortation, when you know something like this is coming, to remain faithful. So, depicted in these verses that we read is the rise of the dark figure, Antiochus Epiphanes, of the Grecians upon the stages of history. And so we want to take a few minutes, and we're not going to be able to do so with the time that we have left, but we can kind of get started with this. And as I've said before, Antiochus Epiphanes is someone that we can identify beyond a shadow of a doubt regarding the book of Daniel and this particular figure. You go back to chapter 8 and you may, or chapter 7, and you may wonder, okay, who was the little horn in that chapter? We surmise that maybe it was Domitian who really began the persecution upon Christians. Some have said, well, the little horn's representative of the persecuting emperors. We can't say with certainty, but we can look at what history tells us, and we can look at the description of verses 23 through 25, and we can say with certainty
who is being prophesied, that is Antiochus Epiphanes. And we'll look and you'll understand what I mean as we engage in a few of these thoughts. Regarding this terrible ruler that was going to come up and oppress God's people, we see that it was going to take place in the latter period of their rule. Remember Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7. Four great empires are going to arise, one after the other. That's the Babylonian. We know the Babylonian, then the Medes and the Persians, the Grecians, and finally the Romans. And so we're talking now about the Grecian time period. So in the latter period of their rule, that is the Grecians, this is when this great ruler is going to arise, this great persecutor is going to arise. Now, Alexander the Great, he died in 323 B.C. He established the Grecian rule. And so the kingdom was then divided into essentially four different empires after his death, and some various state of chaos and reigning over these four components of what was the entire United Grecian Empire. 150 years takes place. And then onto the scene steps Antiochus Epiphanes. At this point in time, the Grecian Empire, just as Daniel had said, it's the latter portion of their rule. 150 years after the death of Alexander the Great was the arrival of Antiochus Epiphanes. It gives another kind of pointer here that helps the people identify when this prophecy is going to be fulfilled. It says when transgressors have run their course, and we'll spend the rest of our time talking about this. As I'd mentioned, Antiochus Epiphanes, who was king over one of the four divisions of the Grecian Empire, it was his desire, because he absolutely was infatuated with the Grecian culture, Grecian religion, all of those things. Think of him like a very, very, very patriotic American who wants to just Americanize everyone. That's the way Antiochus Epiphany was regarding the Grecian Empire. And so it was his desire to Hellenize the entire, all of the countries, his entire domain. And so you can imagine, by and large, this was going to be met with some resistance by the Jews, whose religion is different, who, unlike others, they're told, have no other gods before me. And so when he comes and tries to impose all of these new things on them, there's going to be some sort of rejection. Now, among the Jews, there were this group of what we would call progressives. There's a wave of progressivism, that's a word, sweeping throughout our country today. And so these progressive Jews who were willing to assist the process of Hellenization. And so what they do, rather than resisting what Antiochus is trying to do, is they embrace it. They become a part of it. And they try to use their influence and their clout to help spread that throughout the rest of the Jews. There were two very influential individuals, one by the name of Jason and the other by the name of Menelaus, who were appointed as high priest of the temple. And I say appointed by Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, you'll note those two names are not Jewish, Jason and Menelaus. Those are Grecian names. And so they were Jews that took Grecian names and that embraced this process of Hellenization. And they were appointed to this very influential position of high priest. These Jewish Hellenists immediately received royal approval to then establish a Greek gymnasium, a Greek community and a gymnasium in Jerusalem. And they erected the gymnasium about 170, 169 B.C., and so with this process, Hellenization began to permeate the Jewish people. You go and you read the history, and what we're told is that the priests were the first one to shed their garb and to participate naked in these games of the Greeks. Many of the Jews who underwent and were participants of the sports in the gymnasium, as you know, they participated naked. And so there were many Jews who would attempt to cover up their circumcision. You think of circumcision, you go back to the book of Genesis. That is God's covenant. That is the sign of God's covenant with his people. All of their promises, all of their hopes, all of what sets them aside from the rest of the Gentiles that God has not chosen is the sign of circumcision. And yet, because they wanted to embrace what it was the Greeks were doing, this process of Hellenization, many of them attempted to undergo a process or a surgery called reverse circumcision. Now, you understand how significant circumcision is to God's people under the old law. You can understand how much of an abomination such an act would be. Rather than to stand out as, yes, I'm a Jew and I'm proud of it, I want to appear like a Greek. I want to embrace what it is this great emperor is trying to force on us. I'm progressive. I can go with it. Times are changing. I know maybe my brothers, they can't get along with it, but times are changing, and I'm going to embrace it. And so some of those Jews went to that degree to embrace what it was Antiochus Epiphanes was trying to do. We'll pick up here next week in our study. Remember, this isn't revolving around this prophecy Daniel's making when this great ruler is going to come about. It's going to be in the latter period of the rule, the Grecian Empire, when he arises. It's going to be when transgressors have run their course. And we're just getting started with some of the things that the Jews were doing to pile up these transgressions before God. But since we're at our time to conclude, we'll pick up here next week. Does anyone have thoughts, comments, or questions on anything we're talking about this morning in Daniel 8? We'll try to make a little more application next week. I appreciate everyone's participation in our study this morning.